is the Next Trip Podcast with aviation insiders Doug and Drew. Together, with more than 40 years of industry experience, they are creating a network for other av geeks and travel enthusiasts to obsess about all things aviation. All thoughts and opinions are their own.
Good day and welcome to Boarding Pass 229, operating on April 14th, 2024. This is Drew, an airline ops manager and aspiring Cessna 172 pilot. I'm here with my buddy Doug, an airline pilot. We're here to discuss aviation topics from an industry insider's perspective. Doug, a few weeks ago, I shared a New York Magazine article with you, which basically went through a litany of Boeing's problems, basically everything that we have been talking about or ranting about right on this podcast for years. The author, Jeff Weiss, clearly laid out the aviation oligarchs, and yes, I did say oligarch.
And you meant oligarch, not oligopoly.
I meant oligarch. Yes. I know it's an oligopoly, but I'm considering them an oligarch, many of which rose after the merger with McDonnell Douglas.
It was a great article, and after some research, we learned that Jeff Weiss is also a major reporter on the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines MH370. He was featured in a recent Netflix documentary regarding the flight last year and started a podcast called Deep Dive MH370 to continue searching for answers to one of aviation's greatest unsolved mysteries. Well, as we say, his Boeing article and MH370 sleuthing is podcast gold. So, of course, we had to invite him on the show. And, Jeff, I can tell you, I watched that series as soon as it came out. To see your face on our podcast right now, I know we don't do video podcasts, but it feels like we have a celebrity on. So, this is awesome to actually be sitting here and speaking with you. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, just so for our contributors, where are you? Where are you right now?
Sure. I'm located about 40 miles north of New York City on the Tappan Zee.
Okay.
Home of the famous Tappan Zee Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Which you can see not quite out my window, but pretty near.
We're going to talk about your New York Magazine article. We'll talk about MH370 and your podcast. But tell us your background. Like, is your background aviation or?
In a sense, it is. My dad worked for Honeywell making avionics. So I grew up outside of Boston. My dad worked on 128, sort of a tech corridor. He would go to air shows and things. So I had posters of, like, F-15s mm-hmm. on the wall. The F-15, I'm no spring chicken, let me put it that way. The F-15 was a new thing. It was very exciting. I remember being, like, panicked about the MiG-25, like this super weapon. I grew up sort of, you know, very interested in aviation, thinking planes were cool, but also not knowing any pilots. Mm. So the idea of flying a plane was a very abstract idea to me. I went to college. I was on the school newspaper. I became a freelance journalist. I was working. I graduated in 1988. I was living in New York City, and I wound up moving to Hong Kong.
Mm. Wow.
I became kind of an adventure journalist, and I lived in Hong Kong for 5 years, and I got to do all sorts of fun, exciting stuff. I wound up becoming a contributing editor to Travel and Leisure, which is where I met my wife, and I was doing lots of fun stuff, and I wound up writing an article about fishing for salmon in remote Alaska. Hmm. And so one of the things you can do if you're rich, which is nice, is to fly in a bush plane to a river on the Alaskan Peninsula somewhere and have this river just teeming with salmon all to yourself. And these very expensive guides will take you there. But you can get there by landing on the beach in a Super Cub. So I went back to New York from this trip, and I said to an editor at an adventure magazine, I said, what do you think about bush flying? Like, just bush flying as an idea. He's like, yeah, let's do it. So I wound up spending a week in backcountry Alaska flying around in a Super Cub with this kind of legendary outlaw hunting guide who actually spent a year in federal penitentiary, found out later, for poaching. Anyway, but I'm flying around with these guys. And I thought to myself, you know, for the first time in my life, I saw a guy at the controls of an airplane moving the stick. And I thought, I could do that. Mm. I think I could do that. It seemed like it would be a really cool thing to do. So in 2002, I found myself, I was living in Los Angeles, and I found myself with some time and some money. And I went to this little airport called Whitman in the valley, the San Fernando Valley. I started flying in 152, Cessna 152. That's how it started. So I got my ticket out in L.A. I moved back east. I got my glider rating.
Oh, that's awesome.
It really is awesome. I mean, it's not easy to do. I was living in New York City, and it's really not easy to do. Now I'm in the suburbs, and it's slightly easier to do. It's gotten crazy expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, can I ask you how much you pay per hour for your 172?
Oh, my goodness. I try not to look at the credit card bill when it comes in, but a day of flying is about $300, and that is maybe an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's very expensive, but it's gotten, I mean, it's always been expensive. It's always been a really stupid hobby for a freelance writer to have, but it's, I kind of got into it because I thought, like, how long can this really persist? Like, I feel like at some point, you know, fossil fuels are going to run out, and it's a little bit hard to imagine recreational flying without fossil fuels. So I sort of thought, like, I better do this while I can. It's amazing that you can, like,
I think you'll be okay for a few years. I don't think we're going to be done with fossil fuels and airplanes anytime soon. I wish we could have an electric.
When I was in grade school in the 1970s, we were told, and I was in fifth grade, we were told that there was going to be no more fossil fuels by 1985.
Yeah. Drew and I talk a lot on this show about companies like Archer Aviation who are doing the electric airplanes and things like that. I think GA, General Aviation, because we're not quite to the range yet where you can have a 777 type airplane fully electric. I think that General Aviation could be one of those starters, the catalyst, because you only need enough range to fly for an hour, do steep turns and turns about a point, beat up the pattern a little while, and then go recharge the battery.
Jeff, we kind of went ahead to what got you into aviation. So it sounds like that Bush flight is what drew you to aviation. Yeah. What's the rest of your background? Something about Harvard? You spent some time there?
I graduated from Harvard in 1988, and that's where I was on the school newspaper. And that was kind of how I got started. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't think I could really do that for a living, but I just sort of never stopped. I now have kids, so I'm probably, my wandering days are over.
I have kids, and we still wander sometimes.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, listen, but you work for an airline. So.
That's true. Different. It seems, though, like you are drawn to aviation in your reporting background. So even though you're not, you're tangential, I guess we can say, to aviation, even though you're not in the industry, you don't actively fly or work for an airline, it seems like in your reporting, just kind of in your daily life, there is that love affair with aviation that you are drawn back to it.
Yeah, it's an incredibly cool thing. Flying a Cherokee at 2,000 feet over the Berkshires is a different experience from flying a 777 at 40,000 feet over the Atlantic.
Can I jump in and add? It terrifies me to think about, because I've thought about going to a local place, get checked out on a plane and be able to rent it and fly my family. That gives me sweatier palms thinking about doing that than thinking about flying a 777 from Maui to San Francisco like I did 2 days ago across the half of the Pacific Ocean. It's just the differences, and I'm so far removed from what Drew is doing right now with his training and what you did.
I mean, listen, going to an FBO in some place you've never been to and renting a 1977 172 is infinitely more dangerous than flying a 777.
Oh, it absolutely is.
As you know.
Yes, absolutely.
There's so many things that could go wrong.
I mean, the planes, I have seen planes. I actually did my check ride in California in a 152 where when you did your run-up, just before, actually not just when you did run-up, every single time you were going to take off, you had to do a run-up and you had to lean out the carburetor and burn off the gunk that would accumulate on the spark plugs, because otherwise you'd fail your mag check. Yeah. The guy who gave me the check ride was like, I wouldn't fly this plane. He's like, except because I'm here to check you out, I wouldn't ride this plane. I don't think you should rent this plane. I was like, okay, nice, thanks. It was not well maintained, which they're not always.
I mean, but Jeff,
they're supposed to be. I mean, I have an article coming out in Vanity Fair that touches on the issue of illegal Part 135, which is a whole interesting other topic. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, Jeff, you know, I'm learning how to fly, and the feeling is just, you can't explain it. You're flying over the Berkshires, which I'm sure is beautiful. I'm flying over the Chesapeake, and I'm just like, when my flight is over, I'm thinking to I have to pinch myself. Did that really happen? Was that a dream? because it's so magical. But it's so dangerous, too, because if that engine fails, I don't have a backup like Doug does. I don't have several backups.
No, you do have a backup. You have your good wings.
Oh, yes,
you just
sure.
You need to find a place to put
Drew,
down.
You've got I-95.
I-95, which is never
right
busy.
Below you. Yeah.
All right.
Well, you saw what happened to that Naples, that twin engine out. In Naples recently, where they tried to put it down. Actually, right near my parents' house. I drive that stretch of highway every time I visit my parents in Naples. They're about a mile from there. It's not always guaranteed. Although, if you're going to land on a highway, I'd rather do it in a 172 than a Challenger, which is what I think they were in.
Yeah. Let's move ahead to the news recap. Doug, we were going to talk about our work weeks, but I don't think we need to. Should we just move on? I don't have anything big.
I saw a great sunset in Maui. We can post the pictures. It's all I really need to add.
Okay.
Oh, actually, one thing I will say, though, Mike, I met Mike, our buddy Mike, VIP.
Oh, yes. Shout out to Mike.
One of your friends. He works at the NOC. Met up with him at the Cubs game. It was awesome. Mike, I know you listen. It was great meeting you in person. I'm actually doing that exact same trip again on Sunday. Might try and meet up with him next week. So, Mike, if you're listening, let's try and meet up again.
Mike works in corporate, so any issues that I have at airport ops or Doug has in flight ops, we just blame on Mike. It's easy. He takes it.
Yeah.
He'll bounce it back.
Thanks, Jeff, for the intro. We'll get back to your article about MH370. But for now, we have some work to do. With aviation growing at breakneck speeds after COVID, who would have thought that we'd see layoffs? But that's what's happening at Spirit right now. Why? On Monday, Spirit announced that it would lay off pilots as it delays new Airbus deliveries. And as it has several Airbuses, or as Drew questioned before the show, do we say Airby? What's the plural for Airbus?
You're the writer, Jeff. Is it Airbuses or Airby? I don't know.
If you want a really geeky answer to that, so the word bus is derived from the word omnibus, which means for everybody. So it's actually a Latin declination of an adjective. The proper answer to that would be to be found in Latin, which I studied in college in school, but I don't remember any of it, so sorry for that.
Well, yeah, I know answer. Plural, like I don't know if it's correct, but we say there's a group of buses going by. Right. Maybe that's, since it does derive from Latin, maybe that's incorrect. Anyway,
Airby,
they have several Airbuses, Airby, whatever we want to go with, that are out of service for Pratt & Whitney engine inspections. In January, a federal judge then blocked Spirit's merger with JetBlue, warning that consumers would be harmed by one of the country's largest ULCCs going away, which it may now go away anyways. Spirit has been losing money in a strong air travel market. The company will lay off 260 pilots, along with the airplane delivery delays, which is expected to save the company $340 million.
Here's a question that I have for both of you. Is Spirit going to make it, or do you think there's no hope? Because they keep losing money year after year. What do you guys think? I mean, we haven't looked too deeply into this, but there's analysts who say Chapter 11 is what's knocking at the door. And then I just read something else saying that, you know, if airfares continue to rise, and this whole thing with Boeing, where Boeing can't make these deliveries to United, America, and Delta, your Spirit sitting here with Airbuses, and they still have orders that they can make good on. What do you think? And we'll talk about this in a sec, but they're starting new routes to that are more substantial and not Kansas City to Las Vegas on Wednesday at 6 a.m. It's, you know, actual significant routes.
I have no opinion on this, but aren't they like one of the most hated airlines?
I feel like every airline is the most hated
airline.
everyone has their least favorite airline, and they are very quick to tell you that it's their least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Drew, we talked about Frontier, I think it was on the last episode, and how they're adding business type fares and additional premium seats, if you can really call Frontier seats premium. I know Spirit has their big front seats, which are basically first class seats. It's a 2-2 configuration that doesn't come with like what you would get in first class. I think if Spirit really is interested in starting to get yields and not relying on those $19 fares from, as you said, Kansas City to Las Vegas, turn those big front seats into an actual premium-ish product. You don't have to charge the same as what Delta or American or United, Alaska, anyone who has a true first class product charges, but add some amenities other than just a wider seat with more legroom. Add free drinks. Maybe given they probably don't have ovens on the airplane, so you can't really do hot meals, but at a tapas box, like a lot of airlines were doing during COVID, or now they have the buy on board. Spirit could, they could use that product that they have, and they could actually start to upsell and maybe get people who would buy those seats for that product, as opposed to, hey, you've got a couple of random big seats in the front that mm-hmm. they don't really upsell all that much for, and you don't get anything other than a bigger seat and more legroom.
Okay, so what you're saying is it's like a paradigm shift, or the tables are turned, where the ultra low fare carriers are now adding niceties to get closer to the network carriers, where the network carriers were doing the exact opposite and doing business, yes. Basic economy.
It is exactly that, Drew. It is the big three, the big four, the big five, whatever you want to call it, the mainstay big major carriers added basic economy to be able to compete, while Frontier, while Spirit, while Allegiant were really building up that market. And I really think that the bigger carriers have been eating into that basic economy market. If you can, most of the passengers who are going to pay $39 to fly from Kansas City to Vegas, they fly once a year, once every couple of years. They don't really care what airline they're on. They just care about the timing. And if Spirit can't offer that timing, they're going to go with a basic economy on Delta or on United. Right. And they know that it comes with screens. It comes with even more amenities, even though you're still paying for that basic economy. So now these low-cost carriers are like, okay, well, we need to flip, like you said, flip the script and do the exact same thing that the bigs did to us, but from that premium aspect.
Well, before we, just real quick, so I sent you a couple of the new routes: Baltimore to Sacramento, Baltimore to San Jose, LA to San Jose, lots of San Jose. These are areas where there's lots of money in the Baltimore area, Sacramento area. Is there demand in those markets? Absolutely. So I think they have a shot. I'll just leave it there. What do you think?
Well, when you sent me that list, and I mean, I live in the Sacramento area, and I was like, Sacramento to Baltimore, like, why would they do that? Sacramento is the state capital of the most populous state in the U.S. California is, what, the fifth largest GDP in the world or something? Six, seven, somewhere around there.
Right.
You're linking the capital of the largest GDP state in the U.S. to Baltimore, which is right near Washington, D.C. They're not going to fly to Reagan from here. They can't, because of the perimeter rule. So now you're linking the nation's capital to the state capital of the largest state in the U.S. I mean, it makes sense to fly to Baltimore. It really, initially, I was like, wait, why Baltimore? But after I thought about it a little bit, totally makes sense. Those are not going to be $39 fares.
Right.
A flight from SAC to Baltimore, they're going for yields at this point. They're going for more of the business traveler, which is exactly what Frontier just announced they're doing.
All right, we could talk all day about these mundane things, so apologize, Jeff. Guys, there's no avoiding, we specifically try now to avoid Boeing stories, because it seems like every week we have Boeing lashings, right? But there's no way to avoid it, because on this episode, Jeff, let's talk about your thoughts on where Boeing lost their way. We've read an excellent article in New York Magazine that Jeff wrote. We'll have a link to his article in the show notes for this, but break it down for our contributors. We call our listeners contributors, and we may interject some of our own thoughts. You may want to start, you don't have to do the whole thing, but that in 1997, when they acquired McDonnell Douglas, do you want to start from there?
It's an oft-told tale at this point. I mean, I went on MSNBC the other night, and the host asked me, like, she basically sort of explained the whole thing. She'd already explained, even before I went on, she'd explained about Harry Stone Cipher and Jack Welch and GE and shareholder capitalism and all that. And yeah, I mean, I said there's a whole genre of movies, books, podcasts, TV shows, and it's like we all know that this mentality, this philosophy of maximizing share price at the expense of everything else has destroyed Boeing, or has destroyed Boeing's reputation. And it's like in the water. I mean, this is how corporate governance works in this country. Shareholders want to maximize their share price. They install board members who agree. And then the board members hire CEOs who agree. And then you get this McNerney era stock buybacks, and then Muhlenberg, and then Calhoun. And they're all, I mean, they might as well be the same person, because I'm sure they have different variations, but it's the same philosophy. And so, you know, the idea in aviation accident investigation is like, you have proximate causes and ultimate causes, and this, and there's a chain of causality, and the lack of a bolt makes the door fly off.
Yeah.
Door plug fly off.
Good one.
But it's the philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that, you know, in the 1970s there was this kind of intellectual movement to say that for a corporation to be concerned about its customer welfare, to be concerned about the well-being of its employees, to be concerned about whether its own products are any good, is communism. Literally communism. Because all they have a moral right to be worried about is their share price. And so you get this mentality of, okay, we have billions of dollars. We've got, like, Boeing is the goose that laid the golden egg, right? They have, they're part of this duopoly. They have this. They have an industry that's hungry for their airplanes. Nobody else can make them except for Airbus. But their order books are filled years in advance. All they have to do is not screw up. Just keep making good planes. Mm-hmm. You've got a big pile. You've got a 30-inch pipe with money gushing out of it. And all you have to do is take some of that money, couple bucketfuls, and dump it into making a new plane. Hire some engineers. Maybe even offer engineers a pension.
Right.
You know, maybe like let your unionized workforce like do a careful job. Maybe err on the side of safety.
Jeff,
right?
In your article, you mentioned, and I didn't even realize how big Boeing was. When they merged, they controlled 2/3 of the aircraft sales, right? The 2/3 of the order book. And this is an area that's growing. Travel is growing. How could you not make profits? Why are you so short-sighted that you're only concerned about share price when you have these massive opportunities if you look beyond the fiscal year? It's obviously not just a Boeing thing, right? This is an American thing where a lot of our companies are concerned with the share price and
Let me interject and just add something real quick, and then Jeff can answer this. If you look at the design, like from the announcement of a new airplane, the design process, and then the introduction, testing, and entry into service, it has gotten so much longer. And not even just at Boeing. Airbus is the same way. You look at the defense side, the F-35, F-22. But back in the Vietnam era and before, we were pumping out a new fighter airplane in the U.S. every couple of years. Basically, from someone sitting at some board table saying, I think we should do this, to when it enters service. And now, with technology, I know technology is kind of a double-edged sword. The airplanes are getting so technical, and that is part of what is slowing things down and trying to get through these glitches and trying to do all this. It's not just Boeing. It's also Airbus, where there are these massive delays in entry into service and massive testing problems. I don't know where we lost our way, where we could, in less than 5 years, say, we're going to create a new airplane, and all of a sudden it's delivered to the airline. It doesn't mean that there aren't problems, but I guess the question I will ask is, were some of the early airplanes, or I guess not early, we're not talking like DC-3s and Constellations here, but think back to the DC-10. The DC-10 was mired with problems, and it cost a lot of lives. And the 747, even, which we talk about a lot, Drew, it had its issues as well. Now, I feel like we are taking a little bit longer to introduce some of these new airplanes. I know the media will kind of get on it and be like, well, why is it not faster? Are we maybe being safer in the actual like development process now and losing sight of that, even though we have delays?
I mean, my take on that is that all of these delays are good for Boeing and Airbus. The fact that it takes 10 years and $10 billion to make an aircraft is great, because it means that it's really hard for COMAC or Embraer or Bombardier to come in and join you. Yeah, all you have, if you have the ability to sink $10 billion in 10 years into a plane, and very few people can, great. It's when you don't do that, or, you know, so I was actually talking to a 777 pilot recently, and he said, like, in his opinion, the 777 was the apex of Boeing's achievement. Like, that this was like the last plane that they built that wasn't somehow screwed up, right? And when it came to the 787, you know, they famously said, okay, we want to build a plane on the cheap. We want it to be mm-hmm. cheaper than last time. And it's just, it bites you in the ass. You know, you save now and you pay later. Mm-hmm. They squeeze their suppliers, and then the suppliers this should be an industry of plenty. Everyone mm-hmm. should be happy. Everyone should be fully confident in the quality of their machines and the quality of their lives. People should retire with a big pension. You know what I mean? It's like there's no right. reason to nail yourself to this cross of insane maximum profits, there's just no recognition of human values. And I'll tell you, this is like religious extremism. This vision of capitalism is a cult, and it is incredibly prevalent and is incredibly dangerous. And the question is, will the board of Boeing recognize that they have been lured into this dangerous cult and leave the cult, or will they continue to believe and keep their fingers wrapped around the purse strings?
Well, yeah. I think Jeff.
Drew, I just want to say what you. Yeah, I was going to tell Jeff. Drew talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago. He said if Boeing built better products, I think that you would get more investment in, and the share price would go up as opposed to having.
Yeah, I think companies are just taking for granted that investors want short term profits. A lot of these investors are institutional investors, right? We're talking about 401ks. Pension funds. And if they can make their argument, hey, we're not going to make a profit this year because we're investing all this money in a new aircraft, the 797, just as an example, I, as an investor, I'd be more happy with that than making a short-term profit this year, because I'm going to have those shares in my 401k or my retirement fund for a long time. So I want to know what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years. I don't think it's bad for
a company
to do. It
doesn't matter what you think. It matters what the person who pays more than you for this share. The market will determine who holds the shares. And the guy who realizes that he can break it up and sell it for scrap, if it's worth $100 to you to hold it on, like give it to your grandkids, or it's worth $120 to me to break it up and sell it for scrap, I get it. Mm. I get to make the decision. That's how capitalism works. And so you can change the rules, though. I think what sometimes people don't really realize is that, like, we are humans. We can do whatever we want. We can set the rules. We can have a society that we want to live in. And there's this idea that, oh, no, we have to, like, you know, it has to be capitalism and, you know, all other considerations have to go by the wayside. We don't have to live like that. It's just so incredibly short-sighted that the mentality is the same as the mentality of a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. It's like, I want to maximize for the short term.
That quick
right. I want to have as much pleasure. What can I do to maximize my pleasure right now? The answer is simple. I have to stick some heroin into my bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how Boeing was living. They wanted the cash. They wanted cash, cash, cash always. They didn't want to think about 10, 20 years any more than a heroin addict wants to think about what he's going to be doing in 10 or 20 years. Am I going to be living in a comfortable house with my grandkids sitting on my knee? I just want heroin. I don't care about that.
We do want to move on to MH370. But Jeff, if you could give a recommendation for how Boeing changes, and for one, I guess, can you give a recommendation? And for two, do you think that Boeing is capable of that change? We've talked about how they're going to be changing their CEO here by the end of the year. There's a new chairman of the board. Will some of the board members move out? Like, can Boeing change? And where do you see Boeing 5 years, 10 years from now?
I'll pass along some advice that somebody gave to me when I was reporting the New York Magazine story, which is that a new CEO should come in and say, you know what, investors, suck it mm-hmm. up.
Yeah,
because we're not going to have great profits. We're going to rebuild our mm-hmm. brand.
100%.
We're going to build. We're going to bring the golden goose back to life, and it's going to be a long process. It's a lot. It takes a lot longer to build trust than it does to destroy trust. They have a lot of things in their favor, like the fact that this world is hungry for yes. airplanes, and so your order books will. As long as you can build safe planes,
right?
And try hiring some union employees. Mm-hmm. You know, but here's the thing. The CEO is put in place by the board. The board is put in place by the investors. And I think what's going to save Boeing is what's going to save this entire country which is a public repudiation of the doctrine of short-term selfishness. Mm. I think that the country is hungry for that. I mean, the fact that people are pissed at Boeing, I think, is a way that, like, sometimes a character comes along, like Bernie Madoff was one. Bernie Madoff was vilified because he was the face of the 2008 financial crisis. And I think Boeing is the face of corporate governance malfeasance. I proposed to a guy I talked to who was a professor at corporate governance. I said to him, is Boeing like the canary in the coal mine in terms of like corporate governance? And he said, it's not the canary in the coal mine. It's like there's corpses littered across the landscape. You've got these activist hedge funds that come in and strip mine things. In my own business, journalism, it's like there's just the countryside is littered with the emptied out husks of all these enterprises which have been hollowed out.
We got to get to the MH370 story because that could be a whole episode on its own. Along the lines of what you said, Jeff, this pause with Boeing, with the FAA investigations, the NTSB, all this stuff that's going on, this is actually an opportunity for Boeing and the leadership change, I think. And it is going to cost Boeing some money. They are going to lose some money, and they should tell the investors that. They should dispense with the 737-10. They should dispense with the 737-7. Continue making the -9s. People will still want to buy them. Regroup, retool, and make a 797. Make a world-class narrow-body plane that will run circles around the Airbus A320, which it itself is ancient. And I'm going to put this out there. I know the listeners and you, Doug, hate this, but change the paradigm. The new narrow-body, whatever, should have two aisles, 222 seating, which everyone would love. That's a 797. Faster boarding. We can go all day, but this is a chance for Boeing to do something to shift the paradigm where people are excited about Boeing. I'm going to invest more money if I know that they're working on this and it'll come out in 10 years. Your thoughts, gentlemen, before we go to MH370?
Well, I think that's a great attitude. The thing that I would sort of, the question I'm asking myself is, how serious is this industry about decarbonizing by 2050? Because that's going to change your whole game plan going forward. And I think that 797, if you could roll it out, when could it be flying? 2032 or, I mean, you know, conceivably. You've got the 2030s and then already, you know, when you go, if you want to be carbon neutral by 2050, you better start building those planes
soon.
Now. And frankly, I've written a lot about this for like Business Week and stuff. It's like, we're not even remotely close, and it might not even be possible. I don't think anybody has any idea how you could fly 250 passengers across the Atlantic. You know, unless you're going to use some kind of like
nuclear,
you know, fuel to air to fuel kind of synthetic fuel that's going to probably cost you $10,000 for a ticket across the Atlantic.
Yeah. Well, and Drew and I have talked about this too. And we've talked about how Boeing has said that while they want to introduce a new airplane, they're waiting until there is what do they call it, Drew? A generational leap in innovation or in technological change. They're not ready to do it because right now we talk all the time about how like you can only get 20% gains, which is what each like new generation of airplane has done. You can only get 20% so much, and then it starts slowing down. And we're at the point now where like the airplanes of today, while they're a little bit sleeker, they still look like the airplanes of 70 years ago, 60 years ago. Boeing is waiting on that technological advancement, whether I don't know, it's like hydrogen technology or like whatever it is, whatever they're calling that generational leap in innovation or technological advancement. If they build the 797 today, which we all agree they kind of need to, it still is kind of in that current generation of airplanes. It's not that new technology that we don't even know what it is yet. And hopefully there are smarter people than us working in some lab somewhere trying to come up with it. But if Boeing launches it today, it's not really that leap in technology that we need for that carbon neutral by 2050 or for that brand new experience that is what this industry really needs.
So we're stuck with the 737 for another 20 years, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, we knew that, yes. All right, let's move on. Thanks, Jeff. Great insights. We'll put a link to the article in our show notes for our listeners. Now let's get to the main event, the disappearance of MH370, and your thoughts on what happened. But wait, before you reel us into this drama, let's mention what we think happened to the aircraft. You first, Drew, and this is kind of timely because we're just past the 10-year anniversary of the disappearance.
Yeah, we're just past the 10-year anniversary, and Jeff, Doug and I have not spoken about this at length or done an episode on this since we started the podcast 4 years ago, and neither have I delved into this, you know, kind of fell by the wayside. But 10-year anniversary, it was March 8th, 2014, when this plane disappeared. And real quick, this is what I think happened. I think the plane took off from Kuala Lumpur. It was on the way to Beijing. And there was some catastrophic failure on the aircraft. There was a depressurization, and the crew did their best to manhandle this 777. They did. They were able to turn it back towards home base, towards Kuala Lumpur. I think we all agree with that. Turns back, and then there's nothing. And my feeling is the airplane just continued on that trajectory. It had about 5 hours worth of fuel, at least, right? And it headed towards the southern Indian Ocean. It crashed in there. It completely was destroyed as it crashed into the water. And then we have pieces that we found in Africa, several now, that pieces of 777 that has been found. And that's what happened. We just have to find out what that mechanical failure was. Doug, what do you think happened?
My idea of it has really changed over time. I know initially in the initial, week it was, we thought it was in the South China Sea. That's where everyone was looking. And then we got these pings from the satellites on the engines. And then you had a whole bunch of reports about low-flying aircraft in Thailand and all over. If you think about any time something happens, and if you listen to any sort of law podcast or true crime podcast, people come up with memories later on and they're like, oh yeah, I think I remembered seeing this, and they talk about it. I don't know, Jeff, Drew, trying to remember what you had for breakfast a week or two ago. You probably can't, unless there is some event tying to that particular day. Like maybe you found out that your aunt died 2 weeks ago and you always will remember what you had for breakfast. But if you talk to sociologists and psychologists, they actually say that those memories change over time. And even though you guarantee, and it's the 9/11 effect, I think is what they call it, where it's like people say, oh, I remember exactly where I was on 9/11. And if you, and psychologists have actually done this, and they've interviewed people over time, over several years, and they're like, okay, we're sitting down again. Tell me where you were on 9/11. And they guarantee that I was in this classroom at this time. This was the teacher. And their answer is different than what it was a couple years prior. So all of these reports of like low flying aircraft and I saw this and this happened, those memories change over time. I kind of tend to agree with you, Drew. Like, yes, while it is very interesting that there were all these circumstances, the political orientation of the pilot that came out and then low flying aircraft and all of this, I can tell you flying around the world, there are so many places that don't have good radar, that they just don't see us. And Southeast Asia is one of those areas where the radar just isn't great. So it's hard to really track what's going on. I agree with you. I think it was some sort of catastrophic failure that they tried to go back. And we always say aviate, navigate, communicate. You talk to people after you try and do something with the airplane. And maybe they lost the ability to communicate. And that's why no Mayday call was ever issued or anything like that. We've seen lots of planes that depressurize, like the famous golfer Payne Stewart. He died in, I think, North Dakota or South Dakota. Was it Athenos? What was that Greek 737 about 20 years ago that depressurized? And unfortunately, everyone passed out and no one woke up and the airplane crashed. We have history of this type of thing happening.
Jeff, blow us out of the water or poke as many holes as you can in what we're saying.
Well, I guess I'd start by saying that the case that I've been trying to make in my journalism and also in the podcast Deep Dive MH370 is to make a case that it's not the theory that matters. Everyone has a theory. Everybody has a thing that seems just to their gut seems most plausible. But it's a bit like building an airplane, right? The secret to making a 737 that doesn't pieces don't fly off in midair, is process. How do you, you have to have all the pieces and you have to have a procedure for putting them together one by one. MA370 is a case that's extremely complicated, like a 737. It has lots of pieces, and the only way to get them together into something that coheres and is rigorous is to have a process. You have to be both holistic, looking at all of the evidence at hand, and you also have to be deep. You have to understand completely some of these things that are rather detailed in their nature. And so the thing I often say about MH370 is that as a complex mystery, it looks a lot different from far away than from up close. So if you only know a couple of things, like it disappeared, as you say, after, you know, saying goodnight, Malaysian MH370 over the South China Sea, it turned back, if you only know a few things about it, it's easy to grab onto a theory that seems plausible, that seems simple, and seems to, you know, fulfill all the obligations of a theory. If you then, but the question is, okay, let's look at it once we have a rigorous understanding. Let's lay out all the pieces and look at it comprehensively. A lot of these ideas fall by the wayside, and they just don't match the evidence that we have. Doug, I would agree with you. It's a kind of a bedrock principle of aircraft accident investigation that eyewitness accounts have zero value. They really don't. They just get thrown out. If, you know, sometimes you'll read these NTSB reports and it'll be like, you know, a person on the ground heard the engine, you know, increase in pitch or something. And they'll, and if that matches what the mechanical evidence says, then they'll put it in the report. Mm. Otherwise, they'll just frankly ignore it. So that's a good point. As for the mechanical failure, when the plane first disappeared and we first knew it, we found the primary radar data from the Malaysian military. We saw that it had come back. There was a lot of speculation that there was some kind of mechanical failure. You had this, what they call the hero pilot scenario. They're trying to save everybody. It was nobody's fault. This is a very kind of morally appealing idea. The fact is, when you have a Payne's tour type situation, or actually we had one, Drew, in your area last year, where there was a we don't really know, might have been a depressurization, but what happens is it was coming in towards the airport, kept flying through the waypoints, and then it just went through. What happens when you're at your last waypoint? You go in a straight line. So that doesn't match what happened to this plane. This plane turned. Things were turned off. Things were turned back on. You had full functionality of all of its electronic equipment for 6 hours. It's flying. Planes that are on fire don't really fly for 6 hours generally.
Wait, can I stop you? Can I stop you for just a moment?
Sure.
So my understanding is that it turned. Sure. I don't know about this turn. So you're saying they were still navigating?
It did a 180 at Igari over the South China Sea. It turned again at Penang. And it didn't fly that straight. We don't really know. Primary radar, it's hard to tell. It turned at Penang, flew straight up the Malacca Straits, and then it turned once more slightly to the north, vanished from primary radar, and then it flew for 6 more hours. Then it was presumed to have turned around because of some fancy math that very few people understand. And then that's why they think it went south. For this to work, you have to have people entering more or less random waypoints into the autopilot.
I can tell you.
And there's another thing, too. We pretty much know that the ghost flight scenario doesn't happen, because if somehow it did wind up, somebody came up with this idea that you had the plane went depressurized, but somehow only partially, so that people were able to remain alive, but in this kind of fuzzy state where they could do things kind of randomly. because you can't really explain why they would do this, so you have to imagine this sort of state where people are doing things just by accident, right? They somehow got hypoxic, they turned around, the plane headed into the southern Indian Ocean, and then it just flew straight on what's called a ghost flight scenario, where it just flies straight in a straight line. And the good thing about that theory is that a straight line actually at sort of typical flight speeds and altitudes on a straight line, which is how planes fly, as we all know, matches these ping arcs quite well. The problem is that when you get to the end and you run out of fuel, you wind up right there. You wind up right there on the seabed, and when they search it, it should be there, and it wasn't there. So a ghost flight doesn't allow you to have any explanation for why they didn't find the plane.
Have you ever been in an altitude chamber and done hypoxia testing or training?
I have not.
Is a fascinating thing. I don't know if there are really any civilian companies out there that you can do it, where you can actually like maybe pay and go try it out. It is fascinating how you can actually remain somewhat alert, but not alert enough to know that there is a problem. And you start doing random things. So you start feeling fuzzy, and all of a sudden you're like, ooh, I don't know what's happening. Something is going on. As we fly along, we have divert locations that if something happens, you turn toward that divert location. Maybe there was something that happened, and they're like, okay, we're going to turn left and go to Penang or go to somewhere. And they're starting to plug some points in the waypoint. And then it all goes even fuzzier. And in your mind, if there comes a point where the instructor in the altitude chamber actually has to tell people to put the oxygen on. They are so far gone, but yet they are still pseudo functioning, almost like a zombie, where they're past the point of, in their mind, they're like, ooh, I need to put the oxygen on, but they're still like pseudo functioning. So I can see how that argument could possibly be correct.
A big problem with the theories that kind of get bandied about in the public is that it's easy to take like a certain subset of all the evidence and then completely focus on that. There's a guy who like only looks at like what he thinks is the mechanical damage to the flapron, and his entire story is based on that one thing. There's a lot of other things because one thing happened to this plane. That one thing led to all the evidence that we have now. So the question is like, how do we work backwards from the evidence that we have to figure out what that thing was that happened? The point that I've tried to make is the key clue in this whole event. And this is something I want to ask you, Doug, actually, if I could turn the tables on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's say you fly the 777 a lot. How would you depower the SDU?
I would have absolutely no clue how to do that.
Okay.
And what is that, what does that stand for? What is the
SDU? Okay, well, no, this is actually important. Because, Doug, do you know what the SDU is?
I don't. I have no clue what the SDU is.
Okay.
I wouldn't even know how to begin doing that.
Because the core, the whole mystery turns around of this event that point I try to make to people is this is a very strange event. The authorities who have conducted the investigation kind of treat it like it happened like in a normal way. It's like it's no big deal that this thing happened. I'm trying to say, no, it's a very big deal that this happened. It's really weird, okay? But maybe you disagree with me. So let me say this to you. SDU stands for Satellite Data Unit. It's a box that sits under the roof of the 777 towards the back. It's over the economy class cabin. And it controls the antenna that communicates with the Inmarsat satellite. So it's part of the satellite communication system. What it does is it translates data that's generated by ACARS, by the sat phone, various things that you want to, however you want to communicate with the outside world via the satellite, it comes through this box. This box generates the famous Inmarsat data, including the pings that allow the scientists to derive a route that this plane flew. And it also, so these pings that you've all probably heard about, they tell you how far the plane is from the satellite at any given point. And they also, because of some math, they let you actually derive the route. But it actually derives two routes. Mm-hmm. One route goes to the south, the other route goes to the north. And the way that you tell which one is right, because the plane went one way, but it created a mirror image, a ghost flight. And the way you tell which is the second set of data. It's called BFO. We wouldn't have, and so it was because of this data that the authorities spent 3 years and hundreds of millions of dollars searching on the seabed, did not find it. They fully expected to find it. They did not, and to this day, they can't really explain why they didn't find it. That's why they would care about the SDU. And then here's what happened. The plane takes off, flies to Beijing, 40 minutes in, gets to the last waypoint in Malaysian airspace. A minute before it gets there, the captain says goodnight, Malaysia 370. Everything goes dark. Everything gets turned off. ACARS, ADS-B, the transponder, and the SDU. Here's the thing. There's various ways that you can deselect SATCOM. Like, if you don't want the ACARS to go over SATCOM, you can
We take it off data. Yeah, you can deselect.
Take it off data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you don't have to turn off the satellite. There's no real benefit in depowering the satellite. And it's not something that you train to do. It's not and so this is how you do it. There's three things that you can do. You can either go down into the electronics bay and pull three circuit breakers that are on the left-hand side. And I think you kind of have to know where they are. You probably need a map or something.
Yeah, Drew and I were talking about this ahead of time. I've been in the E&E bay once because I had to on my initial flight. If you were to tell me, like if I was on the sat phone with a problem and maintenance told me, go down in the bay, pull these, do this, I would have absolutely no clue what's going on. That's not something that we are trained on. That's not something right. we need to know in flight.
Okay, see, that's what you're just telling me. That's gold, right? Because that's really important to know. You don't know how to go into the electronics bay and pull these circuit breakers on this thing that you've never even heard of, mm-hmm. right? And then the second way is you can reach up to the overhead panel on the far left. You have an electronic bunch of electronic switches. You can isolate the left AC bus. Let me ask you, Doug, how often have you isolated an entire AC bus?
Zero. And the only time I would ever do that is if there was some sort of malfunction that the checklist then drives us to do that.
On the ICAS?
Yeah. It would be a message that comes up that says you're having some problem, and we go down the rabbit hole of trying to fix that problem. I would say the most likely scenario that I can think of where we would do that would be smoke or fumes from an unknown origin, where if you know where smoke is coming from, like if it's obvious that it's coming from a certain bathroom or something, you can identify that. The scariest of all the malfunctions that I could ever have on an airplane, the scariest is smoke and fumes of an unknown origin, because you don't know where it's coming from. You can't immediately isolate it. And that checklist is dozens of pages long, because it has you literally turn off everything, wait to see if it go, or like turn off things one at a time, and you're going through the entire airplane systems. You're like, okay, the right AC bus is not the one. That's not working. Now we put them back in. Now, and you're hoping that you can get to the source before it burns up the airplane, which is essentially, in a way, kind of what happened to Swissair 111, was they ran out of time before they were able to actually isolate what the problem was.
But Jeff, what are you saying? Yeah. So are you saying that the course that people understand the airplane took, which is southwest into the Indian Ocean, that's not correct, that it went in a different direction?
There's a lot of assumptions that have been made that are based on glancing over really important issues. I haven't even gotten to the third way you can
depower. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me just mention that real quick. And that third way you can depower it is to turn off the entire electrical system. And there's a very popular video. There's actually two really massively popular videos that are circulating on YouTube. Well, you guys, you said you saw my last episode. I talked to this guy, Blanco Lirio, about what he thought about the idea of completely turning off all of your generators on the engines, deselecting the APU so that won't start, running the entire thing off the RAT. And the point I've been trying to make to people, and Doug, I think you can either confirm or deny this, is that turning, like for the pilot of a 777 to turn off the entire electrical system would be a really bad thing to do. Like every fiber of your being would tell you not to do that.
Absolutely. Right?
One of these three things happened, and they're all really deeply, deeply problematic. But we know that it happened. Why did it happen? So the theory that was very viral right now is that the pilot did this because he wanted to not leave any clues, and he knew that if he simply like deselected the ACARs, it would leave behind the act of logging off would leave a little telltale blip
breadcrumb
that would like be less than perfect. And I'm saying, like, listen, first of all, your goal for perfection is leaving you flying a plane for an hour based off of RAT power, which gives you basically, you can move the flight control surfaces and you've got an attitude indicator. And I think that's pretty much like it. Mm-hmm. That's a really radical, really, really, really radical thing to do. And I think it's just really, you can't, this is my problem. This is me against the world. Because the authorities that are looking for the plane and all the people who say Jeff Wise is a conspiracy theorist are simply saying, yeah, he depowered the SDU. And then all these other things happen. I'm like, stop. This guy depowered the SDU. Do you realize what a big effing deal this is? Mm-hmm. This is crazy. And we need to stop and really look hard at this, because everything, this entire edifice is built on the foundation of this SDU getting turned off and then getting turned back on an hour later. We wouldn't have any of this data if it wasn't for this strange, strange act. And when this thing gets turned back on, you're left with an aircraft that I say, and Doug, again, you can disagree with me, it's in an electrical configuration that no plane has ever been in before since. Nobody flies around with their ADS-B, their transponder, their radios, everything's turned off, except they have their satellite communications thing turned back on. It's really weird, and they're just treating this data like, oh, it's got obviously perfectly good. I'm saying, like, listen.
But if someone is acting nefariously, why would they even turn it back on, I guess is my question.
Exactly. I mean, this guy could easily – so what happened is it flies back up the Malacca Straits. It's being observed by Malaysian primary radar. It leaves the last area of coverage because these radars only go so far. 3 minutes later, the box gets turned on. Before that box gets turned on, they're free and clear. They can go. They are in the dark. They are literally invisible. They can go anywhere in the world and no one will know. This box gets turned back on. Now we have this data that tells us that it went into the southern Indian Ocean without any confirming evidence. It's not flying over any land. It's not flying over any primary radar. It's not flying over an aircraft carrier or, you know, near a
But Jeff, we do have evidence. There's all that debris that they found, which are parts of a 777.
Okay. Yes. Very much true. Very much true. And again, when you look at it, this is what I say. It looks different when you look at it close. You say, it's not just debris off a 777. It's a piece of MH370. Washes ashore in Reunion Island. So case closed, right? We have these pieces. The piece came from MH370. We think MH370 went into the ocean based on this very strange data. And here we have this piece. And I think that's where everyone else in the world kind of left it. They're like, we have the debris and we have this thing. And I said, okay, wait a minute.
I think that's where I left it.
Stress test it.
I think that's where I...
Yeah. Okay, but I said, okay, listen, evidence should have confirming evidence. Like normally when a plane disappears, like when Payne Stewart... plane like went in the straight line, it was being seen by primary radar. It was, you know, it had ADS-B probably too. Maybe that was before ADS-B, but you know what I'm saying? There's multiple, and they had the, usually when a thing happens, there's multiple sources of evidence about it. When MH370 turned its box back on in the dark of the night over the open ocean, there was nothing to confirm what it was saying. So when the Malaysian government declared all these people dead, it was doing so strictly on the basis of mathematics of these signals that it couldn't really tell you where it came from. This box came on. They had no idea why it came back on. Okay. Now we get to this debris. Washes ashore. What can we look at that can confirm what happened to this debris? Where did it come from? Well, it's covered in these barnacles. And I spent a lot of time. If you listen to my podcast, you'll hear the word Lepus anatifera quite a bit. These are very common. Cosmopolitan, they're called. And they grow all over the ocean. And as soon as you put something in the water, these things are going to start to grow on it within a week. Okay, so it's very useful for timing the age of these things. And we made a big deal about this. We covered it in multiple episodes in the podcast. But when you look at all of the pieces of debris, every single one, and there were about 36 that were collected, not a single one of them has any marine life on it that's older than a couple months. And so I said, okay, well, I don't know. Is there a good explanation for that? And so I went and I talked to marine biologists who study these kind of organisms. There's not a lot of them, but there's some. And, you know, these guys look at the process by which when you throw something in the ocean, the marine organisms that grow on it. And there's a couple of good analogies. One is there was a tsunami in Japan in 2011. All this stuff got washed into the water and it drifted across the Pacific and it started to come ashore like a year, 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And when it did, you could tell how this stuff had come because it had some stuff from Japan. It had some stuff from the middle of the Pacific. Some of the stuff went a more southerly route. It had stuff from like Hawaii and some of it went more northerly route. It had stuff from the Aleutian Islands. And you could really tell just by looking at this stuff growing on these pieces where it had come from, the entire history of its trajectory through the ocean. You look at MH370, nothing. You know, the authorities were very excited when they first realized that these pieces had Lepus on it, because not only can you tell, you know, how old these barnacles are, but the shells contain clues of the water temperature that it grew in. So you could look at the water temperature history and figure out, okay, a year ago, this was in 22 degree water. Well, it must have been at latitude such and such, and we can narrow down. They really thought they could narrow down where to look for this plane based on the barnacles, except the barnacles are like 4 months old.
So how
do you explain that?
You're mentioning 4 months because these parts were found a year later. So it seemed like they were
16 months. The first piece came 16 months later. So there's about a year-long gap between the plane disappearing and this stuff getting in the water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's follow
up. And listen, I'll tell you, we might have to hear this and say, okay, this guy's crazy.
Well, no.
You take this debris and you go around to any marine. You find a marine biologist who tells you this stuff's been in the water. Now, marine biologists don't like to say that there's a year-long gap because they know that this plane went in the water. But they will tell you, well, maybe something must have happened. And so this is what I hear time and time again when I talk about the SDU reboot and I talk about the year-long gap in the marine organisms, there must be a perfectly reasonable explanation.
Yeah, following
time and time again, there must be a perfectly reasonable explanation. You never hear this. This is a phrase that you never hear when you just have like a normal piece wash up. When the tsunami debris washes up, people don't say, "Oh, there's a. I'm sure there's a perfectly good explanation." No, because it all matches what you think it's going to.
So
be.
We don't want
it looks.
We
right.
don't want to reveal everything on your podcast because this is very intriguing, right? It's probably drawing our listeners in as we talk. There's also a Russian connection which could be nefarious, and it's so interesting. I don't know if you want to mention that or if you want the listeners to listen in and see how one of your theories is.
It's all in the details, and it's all how the thing I really want to emphasize is that I'm not trying to sell a theory. What I'm trying to sell is an approach, a methodology, which is the scientific method, which is like, don't run your mouth off about what, there's so many half-baked theories, and they sound reasonable. I mean, the theory that you guys didn't speculate, but which is kind of the mainstream default scenario about MH370, is that the pilot took it to commit suicide. And again, it's like, if you look at it a little bit closer, that falls apart. That starts to fall apart. Because of all these, this and many more. I mean, we've done 30 episodes of this podcast because there's so many parts to it. And they're all interesting. You know, there's no spoilers, really. I mean, yes, if the plane, I mentioned there were two possible routes. The assumption was that it was the southern route. If we imagine that it wasn't, that it was the northern route, you wind up in Kazakhstan, client state of Russia. Russia has like multiple military installations that are within flying range of MH370, secret bases where this thing could go. You can see them on satellite, you know, maps.
So what is the ultimate goal if that's what it is? If it is nefarious and it ends up in Kazakhstan, what is the ultimate goal? We haven't had a ransom.
Why would they do it?
We haven't seen the airplane show up out of nowhere and fly into a building. I know that there were some ideas about that thrown around. What's the end state of these nefarious actors if this really is
the most asked question? This is the most asked question. Why would anyone do this? I have two answers. The first one is motive is kind of the icing on the cake. What you need to understand with a crime is what happened. Like, what was the actual act? And the data that we have, the evidence, tells us what happened to the plane. Why is like human psychology and humans are...
You always want an answer to something.
Okay. But what is my theory? So this was done in the wake of Crimea being annexed by Russia. And it's about Ukraine. It's still about Ukraine. Because this plane was taken, this mystery unfolded. It was the perfectly engineered distraction because like I was covering it at the time. I was going on CNN like five times a day back in March of 2014. And it's literally all CNN covered. So for this, the world's attention turned away from the annexation of Crimea, this illegal invasion, to this completely other thing on the other side of the world. The thing I point out, why would Putin want to like take a Malaysian Airlines 777? Well, we know that 4.5 months later,
MH17.
Russian military intelligence shot down one of the 16 Malaysian Airlines 777s that existed. Well, there were only 15 at this point because one had already disappeared. But there were 16 in the beginning of 2014 and there were 14 at the end of 2014 because one of them vanished. And the other one got shot down by Russian military intelligence. Why? The story that went around at the time, and it's still largely widely believed, is that it was an accident, that some militiamen got their hands on this thing and just fired it blindly, and they happened to take down this plane. I find that a rather extreme coincidence, and I think people who are in the Air Force and who work with airspace defense know that, like, you don't... The only thing that they train you when they train you how to man a strategic anti-aircraft missile is don't pull the trigger unless we tell you to. And so each of these TELARs, these rocket launchers, has two lieutenants on site, and they are told the lieutenant doesn't shoot it unless the colonel tells him to, and the colonel doesn't tell him to unless the general tells him to, right? You don't go firing these things off. And they were not, it was not run by militiamen. It was in the possession of the regular Russian army. It had been brought the day before from Kursk. It was anyway, so this whole idea, I think I draw this analogy in the Netflix show, but it's like if you're a chicken farmer and, you know, you've never lost a chicken, and then one day you find a bloody chicken carcass and you have no idea who did it. And then 5 months later, you find it. You see a fox jumping over a fence with a chicken in his mouth. You should think about a fox as maybe the perpetrator in the first one, right? The only people that we know in 2014 that were in the business of destroying Malaysian Airlines 777s is Russian military intelligence.
Interesting. Is it real and you?
I am going to subscribe to the podcast now. It's fascinating.
So for the listeners, so we're talking SDUs, we're talking Barnacles, now we're talking Kazakhstan. And did they shoot this MH17 to get parts that they later are strewn over the Indian Ocean to
I get that a lot. The thing I tell the people is, first of all, we know that the flapron came from MH370, not from MH17.
The part number.
And the other thing, too, is that, like, if the Russians did both, they had MH370. Mm. They didn't need to use MH17 parts.
Okay, we're over an hour right now. Jeff, we would love it if you would come back from time to time, give us an updates, and you know, shoot holes through our arguments again. We love the debate, and of course, more talk about Boeing. Hopefully, they find a way out of this morass that they're.
That's one of these things to this day. Why I was so excited to have you on is none of this makes any sense.
Right.
And it's like you said, you can look at it from a logical point of this happened and this happened in a vacuum. But none of this is in a vacuum. It's all happening together, and you just can't fixate on the individual pieces and stovepipe the research. And you have to look at it from a much bigger picture. No, this has been fascinating. Yeah. I know we were going to talk to you about your favorite general aviation airport. We've gone way long. I think that's fodder to have you back on, and we can talk more at some other point when we do a recap with you again. Jeff, thanks for hopping on.
Listen, guys, anytime. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I love. I'm a journalist, right? So I'm always like an octopus, always looking for information. And you guys are full of information, so I appreciate your sharing your thoughts and insights with me.
Jeff, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us and sharing your thoughts on MH370. It's definitely right up our alley.
My pleasure, guys. Listen, my wife's sick of hearing me talk about it, so I'm always looking for new victims.
Well, you know, we say this was a lot of fun, and you know, it was a pleasure talking to you, but we're talking about people's lives here, right? But I think the families of MH370 are really, I don't want to say happy, but they're glad that people still care and people are still looking for answers.
It's not just the families, yes, for sure. It's all of us. Mystery, the reason I feel so passionately about this is because this is not just an aircraft accident. This is something whose implications are really scary and really of like world historical importance, actually.
Yep.
So it's worth like at least looking into it.
Well, yeah. No, Jeff, thank you for continuing to do research, continuing to get guests on like 777 pilots who can reveal stuff. Again, for our listeners, Jeff's podcast, and you do that with what's his name?
Andy Tarnoff is my co-host.
Andy Tarnoff. You can find it. It's Deep Dive MH370 altogether.com. Go on that. It's intriguing. And then also that story on Boeing on New York Magazine. We'll have a link to that as well as the Deep Dive MH370. I look forward to listening. I listened to the last episode and I'm hooked. It's great listening when you're jogging and it really gets you thinking because we think we know the answers, but it doesn't look like we do. So, Jeff, anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's not just a one way just dumping information on people. It's a conversation. I really want people to feel like they can ask questions, express their opinions. I get insights from people all the time. I've got people reaching out to me who know about air traffic control, flight dispatch. There's so many facets to this mystery that I just love people's insights.
Thank you, Jeff. To our friends and contributors, this podcast is your show, so go on our website, nextstripnetwork.com, and let us know what's on your mind so we can talk about it or give us your feedback. You can also follow us on Instagram or Threads at Nextstrip Podcast. Please tell your friends about us so we can reach more people who love aviation and travel.
You can also call our Google Voice number to ask a question or just rant about something. The number is 872-529-5620 when calling from the U.S. Make sure to use country code 001 or +1 when calling from abroad. Thanks to all of our friends and contributors for your support and for joining the conversation. Thanks again, Jeff, for being on. Hopefully we'll have you back on in the future. We'll see all of you next week. And in the meantime, stay aviation tough.
This has been the Next Trip Podcast. Visit nexttripnetwork.com for information about previous episodes, trip reviews, aviation photos, and other aviation-related content. This is your show, so search for The Next Trip on Twitter and let Doug and Drew know what you want to talk about. Not on Twitter? You can also email them at nexttrip.podcast@gmail.com. Please consider leaving a review wherever you download your podcasts. that will help other listeners like you discover this show.